Many years ago, Riley Knight completed a degree in history. This proved to be a bad move, as it was absolutely useless for him. Until now, here's some half-assed history.
What's going on, mate? Great to have you along for some more half-assed history. This week on the agenda, going to be continuing our chat about Gregor MacGregor, the Scottish con man we discussed last week, or we began our discussion last week anyway. All the chicanery that he got up to, this time focusing on the greatest con that he ever pulled, the Poyais scheme. This is very much what he's known as his lasting legacy these days. For those who missed last week, look, I'm not going to do a recap. Go and bloody listen to it. It's a podcast. It's not a radio show that you can miss. You know, go and listen to it, catch up. The rest of us will wait. Go on, pause it. Off you go. Bloody hell. Are they gone? They're gone. Bloody some people. I tell you what, absolute clown fest for you. Sorry, they're back. Excellent. Well, thank you. Good. Well done. We can continue. So, as everyone knows by now, thankfully, Gregor MacGregor, he was a Scottish bloke who went around working as an officer, first in the British Army and then in various Latin American revolutionary armies, you know, Venezuela, whatever else. And while generally a pretty middling officer, his proudest achievements were, of course, the capture of three separate Spanish towns, only to more or less abandon them when the Spanish came back to recapture them, leaving all of his mates behind each time. So, during his time, adventuring around the other side of the Atlantic like this, he was absolutely obsessed with his own reputation and the way that people saw, whether people sort of viewed him and saw him. And I've just realised now I actually am doing a recap of last week, so yeah, sorry for wasting that 40 minutes of the people who went back and listened to it. Anyway, but he was so obsessed with his own image that he would lie about his achievements, his conquests, his titles, everything, basically. And he went so far as to, you remember, he went so far as to make up his own chivalric order, the Order of the Green Cross. So it's safe to say he had his head out a long way up his own ass, but he also seemed to have a pretty effortless magnetism and a real charisma. As a bloke, because he took, not one or two, but actually three dismal failures as this, cowardly commanding officer before the stories caught up with him and he started running out of friends. And that, as everyone knows by now, that is where we left the story last week. MacGregor, he had come back from his disastrous attempt to capture and hold the town of Rio de la Hacha. He lost hundreds and hundreds of men that he was in charge of there. And everyone now from Jamaica to Venezuela is shunning this bloke. And this is where MacGregor disappears from history entirely, completely disappears off the history books from October 1819 to April 1820. We just don't have any idea where this bloke was or what he got up to, but we do know what happened, however, as soon as he re-emerges in a big way like this, and that's where we're going to be having a chat today because of what he got up to after he re-emerged in April 1820, the Poyais scheme. So, April 1820, out of nowhere, MacGregor, he appears. He appears again in an area that is rather worryingly named the Mosquito Kingdom. Now, I don't get bitten by mosquitoes. I'm very lucky. I don't know. My blood must not taste all that good. But, my mum, my brother, my girlfriend, everyone's getting eaten alive by mosquitoes whenever I go outside. And I'm just there laughing at them all like that, having a great time. But even so, even with my immunity to mosquitoes, I still wouldn't be too excited to visit a place called the Mosquito Kingdom. I really would not. I mean, first of all, it should be called the Mosquito Queendom, as it's the female mosquitoes who are, getting out and about and biting. Well, actually, they're not biting people. Technically speaking, they're using their, proboscises or proboscis or whatever to pierce your skin. So technically not a bite, whatever. What am I talking about? This isn't half-assed zoology. Bites are fine. We'll call it a bite. But seriously, what the hell's going on with mosquitoes anyway? They kill hundreds of thousands of people every year because they transmit diseases. They're such good disease vectors. They're such effective, because they're transferring blood here, there, and everywhere like that. They also only live for about a week, maybe 2 weeks, and spend most of their lives making other lives, the lives of other animals, pure misery. I don't know. Maybe that's why they like to kill other animals, because they're all pissed off that they get such a short innings themselves. Anyway, mosquitoes, as far as I'm concerned, they can go. Long story short, they suck, both figuratively and literally, and I don't think I'd like too much to visit a mosquito kingdom or queendom or any other territory that's overseen by mosquito-based governmental systems, I would say. Although, I suppose it would be pretty sweet to see a giant mosquito in a throne, wearing a crown, Queen Squito, 283rd of her name, sipping on a goblet of the blood of her sworn foes. Anyway, MacGregor, He emerges back into the history books in April 1820, as I've said three times now, in the Mosquito Kingdom, which straddled the modern-day border between Nicaragua and Honduras. There's an area in Nicaragua still referred to as the Mosquito Coast, although back in McGregor's day, the kingdom was a long, thin strip of coastline that went all the way along the Nicaraguan coastline there from Costa Rica all the way up north over the Honduran border. Now, the kingdom at this stage, it's a British protectorate with local kings that are crowned to prevent the Spanish from treating it as unclaimed land, although de jure, it's under the control of the Spanish because the Spanish had huge influence in that region anyway, but the British have technically lay claim to it. Now, one of the blokes that the British have crowned as a king in order to, you know, try to legitimise their claim to this area is a fellow with a very, very regal name of King George Frederick Augustus. And it's actually with this bloke that the story of the Poyais scheme begins, because on the 29th of April, 1820, King George Frederick Augustus, he sells our mate Gregor MacGregor over 32,000 square kilometres of land. That is bigger than Belgium, or for any revered US listeners for which there are only two countries, America and everyone else, this is about the size of Maryland. So this is a big, you know, sort of tract of land for one bloke to all of a sudden be in charge of. But Gregor MacGregor, he's been hanging out in the Mosquito Kingdom, and he manages to purchase this great big area off of the King of the Mosquitoes there. Now, obviously, I guess not obviously, but, you know, we actually don't know too much about this transaction. Apparently, MacGregor paid for it with jewels and booze and other stuff like that. But what we can guess is why he might have bought it, actually, because he, you know, he's obsessed with grandeur and titles, and he names this new dominion of his Poyais after the locals that already live there, but then dubs himself the cazique of Poyais, which was a Spanish-American word that loosely meant prince, right? So buying Poyais basically gave him another great big fancy title and another way to con people into thinking that he's, you know, this great big knob. So absolutely perfect. He loves this whole plan. He's a big fan of it because obviously it makes him look all grand and large and in charge. Now, by all accounts, it's a proper tropical paradise, the area that he's bought, you know, bloody beautiful beaches, palm trees, all the rest of it, white sand, blue water, loving it, absolutely fantastic. Now, it's very nice to look at, you know, but unfortunately, the whole place is extremely inappropriate for any kind of, you know, sort of vis-a-vis, you know, boring stuff like agriculture and habitability. But, you know, no worries, looks pretty spiff on a postcard, and that's the main thing here. And MacGregor, he's got very, very big plans for this new tropical paradise that he's come into here, this, you know, more or less completely undeveloped area. You know, he's got very big plans for it. Don't even worry about it. He's got big things on the horizon coming. So, new land, new title, Cazique MacGregor. He heads back to the old country, back to the UK. Oh, sorry, not the UK at this stage. Great Britain at this stage. It's not the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland just yet. Just Great Britain. He gets back to the old country, back to Great Britain to run his next bit of gear there. The con is on. Now, despite his name being mud throughout the Caribbean, through Latin America, because of the stuff that he's done at Rio de la Hacha and whatever else, and also despite Michael Rafter, one of the blokes who had served under him during, you know, these remarkable failures he had, you know, in the last episode, Michael Rafter actually wrote a book about MacGregor and how much of an idiot he was and how much of a, you know, how terrible he was as a commander, as an officer. When he sails back into London, MacGregor, he's marching around like he owns the place, and he's immediately welcomed into higher society because he's walking around with these big, you know, these medals and most of the ones that he's just made up, and these titles and everything else, and all of a sudden everyone's wanting to be his best mate. He talks a huge game about his exploits in Latin America, and of course he's remembered for his association with the diehards of the 57th Foot Regiment, and so people are bloody loving him. This foreign potentate coming in, this foreign bloke coming in, walking around, strutting around, all these medals and everything else like that, all these war stories and fancy titles, and of course he's the hottest social property. He's off at fancy dinners. He's eating them whore. There's the whores d'oeuvres. You know, he's talking out his bum about his adventures on the other side of the world, and everyone is lapping it up. And now, of course, the main thing he's focusing on, he's going on and on and on about his new position as the Cazique of Poyais, how brilliant his little kingdom is, and all the rest of it, and people are falling for it hook, line, and sinker. They're completely taken in. Now, to be fair, it is not that implausible that a new country and a new government could have sprung up overnight like this in Latin America, given how, you know, politically unstable the region was, with shifting colonial powers all the time, that sort of thing. So it was believable enough that this bloke had come back and, you know, fought his way through the colonial wars wars for independence back in over there in Latin America, and then have been rewarded with basically his own kingdom. It's not completely out of the question. So people aren't that stupid for having believed him. But any way you slice it, you know, whether you believe him, you don't believe him, whether you think that people are being taken in, whatever else. He was the hottest social property of the season. He is hanging out with everyone in London, all the way up to the Lord Mayor of London, right? He's spinning this yarn about why he's back in London. He's back, you know, being as an official guest of King George IV, the coronation of the king there, on behalf of the nation of Poirier, as well as to find people who want to move there or invest their money in it. And he's using all of these higher society shindigs, I guess they probably wouldn't call them shindigs, would they, to get the rich and the famous on board. And would you believe it? Again, they are falling over themselves to hand him money. They're falling for his rubbish like you wouldn't believe. And there are a few, I mean, obviously, you know, I'm not trying to take anything away from McGregor as a con artist. He's obviously very, very good at his trade here. But there are a couple of other factors that sort of weighed in on his immediate success in parting these fools from their money here. Because at the time, and he chose his moment exceptionally well. At the time, he's done his homework. He's figured out that now is a very good time to go around and have all these little pitch meetings that he was having for people in London. And as a result of this, because of his preparedness, because of the work that he put in, and because of the timing of this whole con, McGregor went around convincing people to invest or even move to what was at this stage effectively a made-up country. And I said that he chose his moment well, and it's very true, because in 1821, at the time he's going around canvassing people for cash, the Napoleonic Wars were over, the British economy was firing on all cylinders, and there were very low domestic interest rates in Britain itself. People were looking for more lucrative ways, you know, more investments with potentially a higher level of return. So they're looking for foreign investments. They're looking for other ways to other places to put their money. So the atmosphere was ripe to take these rich people to the cleaners and take all their money off them. But how, you might ask, how do you convince that all these people that Poirier even existed as a country, let alone, you know, had an established government and a prosperous population? Well, no half measures with our mate McGregor here. Remember, there's hardly anyone living in Poirier. McGregor is going around talking about it like it's this new tropical paradise with towns and ports and a government and economy and all the rest of it. You may have heard of famous con artists and the scams they've got away with over the years, taking advantage of, you know, the gullible, the foolish, or just the unlucky. But McGregor, with the Poirier scheme, kicked off what has to be one of the most incredible and brazen confidence tricks in human history by essentially inventing an entire country with documentation to prove it and convincing people to chuck their money or even themselves at it. He did this by publishing a 355-page book that presented itself as a guidebook to the territory of Poirier and was filled with the most unbelievable nonsense. That's the thing. That was the problem. It wasn't unbelievable nonsense. It was totally believable nonsense, right? A lot of the book had huge big bits ripped out of it from other books about the nearby area. So stuff that was written very much in the style and was very much believable about that whole area of, you know, that we'd now call Honduras, Nicaragua, or whatever else like that. So there's a lot of stuff in there that you're going to believe. But this book, apart from all that, was completely made up. He pulled it out of his ass almost entirely, all the bits that he wrote here, because it went on and on and on about how excellent the climate was, how fertile the earth was, how bountiful the wildlife was, all the rest of it there like that. This book, it talked about the completely made up capital of Poirier, which was St. Joseph. It talked about it being a bustling town of 20,000 people with palaces, mansions, banks, cathedrals, opera houses, theatres, all the rest of it. But my favourite bit about this guidebook, you know, it's got a guide to the town. It's got all the information about, you know, potential agriculture, hunting, fishing, whatever else like that. But my favourite bit about it, you'd think this would be enough to make people sort of sit up and go, whoa, whoa, hold on a second, what? Because he claimed, Gregor McGregor claimed, that the rivers and streams in Poirier were so rich with gold that little bits of gold littered the bottoms of their banks. McGregor is touting this book filled with all of its knowledge, you know, saying to people, oh, you know, you can go and you can, if you go and hunting for one day, it'll feed your family for a week. You can just go and scrape your hand along the bottom of a river and you'll come up with a fistful of gold. He's going around talking this huge game about this made-up country. And the thing is, he makes it very believable because he doesn't stop there. He's not only printed, at great expense, printed out this fake guidebook. He's also printed all sorts of other bits and pieces to support his rubbish. Pamphlets, leaflets, even land certificates that he's trying to sell to people saying, you know, if you invest, you'll get this land. You're going to have a huge rate of return on it, whatever else like that. there is so much detail. It's so convincing, all the stuff that he's carting about. You know, he explains the parliamentary system in detail. There's a fictional constitution. He talks about the trading and commerce laws over there. McGregor has it all covered. Last week, we talked about how he spent ages sitting around designing his fictional chivalric order, the Order of the Green Cross. Remember that, with, you know, drawings and diagrams and everything. This time, and I mean, this guy must be, he must have been so into doing this sort of stuff, because this time he's invented an entire country. He's illustrated, he's got an illustration of the Poirier coat of arms. He draws the uniforms that the armies are wearing. He makes up this entire system of nobility and this awards, this honor system, all the rest of it. He's like a bloody DM making up an entire campaign setting just by himself. Unbelievable. But the most unbelievable thing is, it worked. It all bloody worked. The fact that he had so much detail about this place, and because, you know, again, I talked about the costs involved in printing books and certificates and all the rest of it, people are taken in by it. They think, well, this bloke's not going to waste his money on something that doesn't exist like this. So people are, again, falling over themselves to hand him money. And it's not just people. It's not just people. He's raking it in from these rich people who are, again, you know, tripping over themselves to invest in Poirier. He also cons a major London bank. A bank! Into loaning him £200,000. In today's terms, that is £25 million. All of it based on a fake government in a fake country on the other side of the Atlantic. And this bank is also handing him out, or this, you know, this massive loan here like that, just on his word, more or less, and these books that he's waving in their faces. No one wanted to miss out on investing in Poirier, and McGregor is absolutely loving it. He is strutting about like the cock of the walk with his invented titles and all the rest of it, basking in the warm glow of the spotlight. I want to change the tone of the show. I mean, we don't get serious very often here in Half Arsed History, but just for a second, yeah, I want to sort of have a bit of a tonal shift, because I think we tend to look on people like McGregor as cheeky rascals who get away with it. People who fly in the face of authority, manage to do people over, you know, in the process generate a story like this one, entertaining and funny, and, you know, puts a smile on your face. But there is a darker side to this sort of thing as well. I mean, you know, months and months ago, we talked about Ned Kelly on the show, and he's revered in Australia as a larrikin, you know, a bloke who stuck it to the man and showed him who was boss. But, you know, we forget that he was an actual literal, you know, robber and murderer as well. And, you know, that sort of stuff tends to, you know, be overlooked in a nice romantic story like this one. And McGregor, the story of McGregor is no exception. While, you know, no one's getting too upset about him fleecing rich people, there is another side of this con which we're going to explore now that was perhaps a little less forgivable, because it's very easy to overlook someone like McGregor or, you know, whomever else tricking wealthy people into giving up their cash. We don't tend to lose sleep over, you know, rich people getting done like this, and rightly so. But McGregor's con, however, it went from being a sort of quote-unquote harmless one to one that was essentially murderous when he started looking for emigrants to Poirier. This country didn't exist. Let's not forget, this country does not exist. It is a sparsely inhabited, completely undeveloped area of land that has no real prospects for supporting settlement. But Poirier is the basis of McGregor's scheme to go around and trick people into packing up their lives now and sailing over there to start anew, all based on utterly false promises about what life would be like to live there. You know, so what he does at this stage to try to get people to move there is he goes back up to Scotland. He moves back up to his native Scotland as he guesses that people there would be more likely to believe him as he was Scottish himself. And I don't think this, even today, I don't think this is an unreasonable thing to think. Scottish people are very proud of themselves and they're very proud of their country. And I think that, you know, they're very proud of Scots who go out and do well in the large, big, wide world there. I was about to say the real world, sorry to all my Scottish listeners. And so, you know, when someone who's made it big comes back to Scotland, you know, people can be very proud, can be listening to what this bloke has got to say. So he's cutting about in Glasgow and Edinburgh. He's rounding up people who are interested in moving to this, you know, supposed tropical paradise. And if you'll remember the Darien scheme from episode 50 a couple of weeks ago, when Scotland tried and failed to set up a colony in Central America, McGregor is going about telling everyone how this is a new chance for Scotland to right that wrong and establish Poirier as essentially a Scottish run or a Scottish influenced territory. And people are clamoring to sign up. More and more people are signing up to sail over there. And the con has become more and more attractive to investors because now, if they had any doubts about the potential success of this venture, they're thinking again after seeing hundreds and hundreds of people line up to, you know, to pile aboard these immigrant ships. So after McGregor has sorted out what he wants to do with sending these immigrants over to the other side of the world, he loads up two ships to the brim with hundreds and hundreds of poor souls. And he sees them off from Scotland to Poitiers in September and October in 1822. And look, I don't know what's going through his head at this stage. And, you know, we've sort of characterised this bloke as a bit, you know, as again, a bit of a rogue, bit of a lovable, cheeky rascal here. But he was sending these people to their deaths. And I don't know what he was thinking when he did it. McGregor, he was there to see these ships leave. He turned up with the freshly printed Poitiers dollars for which people, again, scrambled to change their actual real British money for. They're feeling so lucky that they're going to turn up with this freshly minted money ready to spend it in the town of St. Joseph there. The second ship, it left with such so much pomp and circumstance, such a fanfare. It left with a broadside cannon salute and proudly hoisted the flag of Poitiers before leaving Edinburgh. Now, the ships, they made it across the Atlantic safely, very uneventful journeys, thankfully for all on board, but that all changed once they arrived. The first one arrived in November 1822, and then the second arrived in 1823 in March. And the emigrants were shocked to find neither hide nor hair of this great nation of Poitiers. All the big talk from the guidebook, all of it is, of course, false. They find that out very, very soon. The magnificent city of St. Joseph is nowhere to be seen, and there are no rivers running with any gold or anything else like that. So it's safe to say they've been sold a false bill of goods here. It's not looking good for these new Poitiers immigrants here. Nonetheless, however, they exit the ships, they begin to try to set up shop, they reason that there must have been some kind of mistake, navigational, whatever else like that, and that the government of Poitiers will soon locate them because obviously they know that they're coming. The settlers, they send search parties inland, they're looking for any kind of, you know, settlement or anything else like that, but of course there's nothing to be found. Well, actually, that's not quite true. There are a few things to be found. One search party runs into some locals. Who, after hearing them ask about any towns or settlements nearby, they take them to the abandoned and overgrown ruins of a quickly aborted settlement that was, you know, from decades and decades and decades ago. And, you know, after these explorers come across a graveyard and a couple of ruined buildings, they realize, well, we've probably been done here. They go back to the commander of the expedition, a bloke whose name is Hector Hall, and Hall figures it out. He goes, well, yeah, okay, we've been diddled. It's been a diddling, a classic diddling here from McGregor, but Hall, I think, quite wisely decides not to share this with the rest of the settlers because, I mean, at this stage, I didn't say this, the other ships have sailed off. They're basically stuck there. They're trapped. They've got no way to leave. And so going and, you know, spreading this story amongst the settlers would have been, I think, a terrible idea, inducing panic and whatever else there like that. So instead, what Hall does, he tries to figure out a way to save the people under his charge. And what he does is he makes an effort to try to get in touch with the Mosquito Kingdom, right? He knows that they at least might be of some help. They've got some connection to the outside world there. But the rest of the settlers, not knowing how dire their straits are, they go about their business. They're cheerfully unaware of the fact they've been done. They're convinced that it's all just a big mix-up and it'll all end happily enough, or that someone else has stuffed things up. It's definitely not McGregor's fault. He's a lovely chap, and he's not the one to blame. Hall, however, unfortunately has no luck with the Mosquito Kingdom. King George Frederick Augustus didn't know anything about the nation of Poitiers, and when Hall returns to him, he's just got no good news to share, and the Mosquito Kingdom aren't too interested. So, as I say, these two other ships, they've nicked off. They're stuck there. But the good thing is they've unloaded all the supplies. They've got doctors. They've got medicine. And so they're not in a totally desperate position as they're, you know, setting up shop and trying to establish a new settlement. But again, it's not exactly what they signed up for. And even with all the optimism, all with, you know, everything else like that, the cracks begin to show sooner or later when the rainy season arrives. And when the rainy season arrives, disease comes with it. Malaria, yellow fever, all sorts of tropical diseases start to spread throughout the settlers. And then tragically, people start to die. And in May 1823, Hall heads off to the Mosquito King again to ask for aid because of how desperate the situation is here. He's got people dropping like flies. Unfortunately, everyone is sick. You know, the settlement is starting to fall, or this nascent settlement they're putting together is starting to fall apart. But while Hall is away, a ship arrives. A ship just happened to go past where the settlers were. It's carrying the chief magistrate of Belize, a bloke whose name is Marshal Bennett. He's off to visit the Mosquito King. And he is shocked to discover this little settlement wasting away with these abandoned settlers in the middle of nowhere. 10 people had already lost their lives to disease and one, unfortunately, to suicide. And heaps more were sick as anything thanks to these diseases that were rife in the settlement. So Bennett, he comes ashore and he tells them in no uncertain terms that there is no such thing as Poye, there is no Kazik thereof, and that they were all going to die unless they left and came back with him to a safer part of the world, back to Belize. So while the settlers are debating what to do in the next couple of days, Hall arrives back from his voyage to the Mosquito Kingdom, and he brings back with him the King of the Mosquitoes himself. He brings back old mate King George Frederick Augustus, and he is hopping mad, I can tell you. When he's now realised what is going on his territory, don't forget this, he tells all the settlers that to clear off quick, bloody smart. He doesn't want them there on his land. He says, yes, look, I sold a stack of land to MacGregor, but I never made him a Kazik. I never gave him sovereignty over it. I never relinquished my sovereignty over this land. It's still mine, as you know, I'm still your king here. So you've got two choices, mate. As you can either swear fealty, you can either become a loyal citizen of the Mosquito Kingdom, or, because you know, I definitely didn't give MacGregor permission to start reselling it, so you don't have any claim to this. If you're not going to swear allegiance to me, you can get back on your ship and you can get out of here. You know, he's telling basically all of the settlers they're illegal immigrants. They have no right to be there, and they've got to bugger off right here, right now, unless they swear allegiance to, you know, and become part of the Mosquito Kingdom. Now, I don't know about you, but if I were angrily told to swear allegiance to the King of the Mosquitoes, I absolutely would not be doing it. I would be packing my bags and getting it. I'd be moving out of town. So, and again, most of the settlers, they make that decision. They almost all of them pack up and get ready to go with Chief Magistrate Bennett. Now, Bennett, he has to make 3 trips there and back to pick them all up, which is, I have to say, it's bloody good of him. And he deposits all of the settlers that wanted to or were able to come back to Belize. Now, around 40 of them stayed behind, and unfortunately, most of them, they didn't go because they were too sick and too weak to make the voyage. So very unfortunate for them there. And what's more unfortunate is for those of them who did make it back to Belize, a lot of them, the story didn't get any better. The conditions in Belize weren't much more favourable for good health than there were in Poye, and the diseases again rip through all of these weakened settlers, and many of them die, most of them, in fact. And this is where we see, I think, in the cold, clear light of day, the consequences of MacGregor's actions. And I think it's fair enough to let him get away with a cheeky con, separating rich people from their money. We're not going to come down too hard on someone like that, especially when it happened, you know, years and years and years ago, and it's given us a good laugh. But still, what he did here in sending these people to this made-up country that was not prepared to support the life of these settlers there like that, it is a very, very, very grim thing to have done indeed. And you know, it's not, it means that, I don't know, it's much more difficult to forgive him for sending hundreds of settlers, you know, across the oceans to a horrible death far from home. So we'll keep that in our minds as we continue to talk about MacGregor here. Anyway, the British representatives in Belize, they immediately send word back to Britain to tell them what has happened, and in doing so, they actually make it possible for the Royal Navy to intercept 5 of the 7 more ships that MacGregor was getting ready to send back across the Atlantic. 2 of them still make their way off, but the British, the Royal Navy, is able to chase down the other 5 and turn around, tell them, look, you're on a fool's errand here. This is not what you think it is. So they come back home and the people there are safe. Now, the 2 ships that had already left, they actually avoided being abandoned Poye, luckily. One ship made it all the way to Poye, and after seeing the state of the abandoned settlement and what had happened there, they very quickly realized, well, okay, this is not a good idea. We are going to go back to Belize and hang out there, see what's happened instead. And the second ship didn't actually make it any further than Belize before finding out the truth. So from there, all of these settlers, all of the people who had been conned or sent over there like that, they either go back home, they stay in Belize and set up shop there, or maybe in Honduras as well. But a lot of them actually ended up immigrating to the US. So they definitely took the scenic route, but ultimately for the second round of settlers there, you know, it's not too much of a tragedy, luckily, there like that. But what happened to MacGregor while all of this is going on? A very good question, one we're going to come to right now. He remained behind in Britain initially. He's rolling in cash. He's still organising more ships and more investors for Poye. Now, it's again, I don't know what is going through his head at this stage, but a very famous biographer of MacGregor, a historian named Sinclair, suggested that MacGregor really earnestly believed in what he was doing, and wasn't just trying to con people out of his money. He really did think that people were going to be able to set up a nation over in Poitiers. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But when the chickens start coming home to roost for McGregor here, he realizes that he might be in a bit of trouble. Word has reached Britain of the total failure of the settlers in Poitiers, and the truth, you know, the truth has dawned on all those involved with McGregor that they've been swindled. So towards the end of 1823, McGregor realizes that he is going to have to start to, you know, he's going to have to make himself scarce, and he starts to make secret plans to do just that. Up until this point, he'd been full steam ahead with the Poitiers scheme. He's still trying to get people involved and, you know, organize more ships to be sent over, as I said, all sorts of stuff like that. But when he hears that a group of survivors are coming back from Belize, he decides, yep, okay, probably time to make myself scarce, get out of here, I reckon. So when the survivors arrive back in London on the 12th of October 1823, they find that McGregor has skipped town. He's told everyone that he was heading over to Italy for the health of his wife there, but he actually secretly went to Paris instead, right? But here's the best part. Here's the funniest part. When the survivors get back, you know, we've got McGregor fleeing across onto the continent to try to hide from the wrath of these settlers. But when they get back and when they're asked what happened to them, guess who they blame for it all? They don't blame McGregor. Nope, not at all. He gets away with it scot-free. They blame Hector Hall, the commander of the expedition, one of the commanders who had been off trying to save their skins, you know, going and treating with the Mosquito King. They accuse him. They claim that he was the one who had conned McGregor. They said that he'd embezzled money and had given them the wrong directions. He'd been deliberately trying to run the settlement into the ground to line his pockets there like that. Here's what some of the returned settlers, they swore in an affidavit. This is what they said after they came back. They said this. We believe that Sir Gregor McGregor has been worse used by Colonel Hall and his other agents than was ever a man before, and that had they done their duty by Sir Gregor and by us, things would have turned out very differently at Poitiers. So McGregor, he cannot believe his luck. He cannot believe his luck at this get-out-of-jail-free card. And immediately, he starts singing in chorus with these returned settlers. He goes around talking about embezzlement and fraud and what he'd suspected and how he'd been ripped off and taken advantage of and how all the rich merchants in Belize were working in concert with Hall. They were trying to sabotage Poitiers as it threatened their profits in the region, all this sort of stuff. He's suing newspapers who are claiming that Poitiers doesn't exist. He's denying all wrongdoing and generally just being a bit of a dickhead about it. He is, and incredibly, unbelievably, after doubling down on this lie, he gets away with it. And what happens next is absolutely astounding. I've already told you that he's traveled to Paris, right? And once he's there, once this whole thing with the returned settlers emerges, do you know what he starts to do in Paris? He runs back exactly the same con, now trying to trick the French into investing in and traveling to Poitiers. He has learnt from his mistakes, however, and this time he distances himself from the con by working indirectly, doing all of his business through a French company, a French sailing company or a French overseas colonization company there like that, that would do all the actual settling itself rather than directly managing the new rounds of immigration himself. Again, giving himself plenty of distance, giving himself plenty of plausible deniability. And once again, it seems like everything is going to fall into place for McGregor as the money starts rolling in again and as more and more immigrants line up to be part of this venture once again. The company goes as far as preparing a ship to leave, gathering immigrants together, but it is here, at long, long last, that McGregor hits a snag because the French government, after doing a little bit of investigation, a little bit of homework about this whole Poitiers system, right, they have all these people come to them asking for passports so they can leave, so they can emigrate from France over there to Poitiers. And the French government, the authorities, they refuse to issue passports to these emigrants who want to leave, as the government has never heard of Poitiers, doesn't believe it exists, and is not going to give its citizens permission to leave. They order the police to investigate this whole Poitiers business much more in depth, much more vigorously. And from there, the threads begin to unravel pretty bloody quickly. I can tell you this. The French authorities, they realize that this McGregor fella, he's a walking colostomy bag. He is that full of crap. And order his arrest along with his associates who are over there in France. And so in September 1825, two of McGregor's colleagues are arrested while he, of course, manages to escape. He goes into hiding. Another associate of his flees as well into the Netherlands. But this doesn't last long. because McGregor is tracked down and he's arrested in December, where he and his associates, they are charged with a laundry list of fraud-based crimes. Now, after being locked up, McGregor tries everything to get himself out of jail. He first tries to make public pleas for aid, saying he's been arrested for no reason, in contravention of his human rights. He doesn't know what he's supposed to have done, and that doesn't work. So he tries a different angle. He says, look, I'm a big deal. Don't you know this? I'm the Kazika Poye. There's going to be trouble what he described himself as one of the founders of independence in the New World. If I'm not released quick smart, there's going to be big trouble, and that doesn't work either. So then, rather neatly, he just tries to claim that he has diplomatic immunity as the leader of a foreign nation, and needless to say, that doesn't work either with the French. None of it impresses them all that much, and they ignore everything that he's got to say. They want to bring him to trial. They want to bring him to trial and make him answer for what he's been doing here. But unfortunately for them, this other associate that has fled France in the Netherlands has taken with him all of the documentation, all of the evidence that they need to make a case against McGregor. Now, they're trying to extradite him. The French are trying to extradite him from the Netherlands, but it's not working. And so McGregor, he realizes that he's got a real opportunity here. And now we're about to come to a bit of ridiculous good luck that this bloke had, because he says now to the French authorities, all right, you know what? Obviously, something's gone wrong. Obviously, there's been some kind of a mistake. If there's been a con, if there's been any kind of fraud, I know nothing about it. But I'll tell you who does. It's this bloke who ran off to the Netherlands with all the evidence. I want to cooperate. I want to help with your investigation. I had no idea that the bloke in the Netherlands, he was in charge of everything. And I think I've been conned as well, is what McGregor says, by this whole Poye thing. So, you know, let me help with this investigation. So while he's spinning this incredible yarn to the French authorities about how the whole thing supposedly went, he wrote this big, long backstory, you know, that completely exonerates him, talking about how he'd got involved with the mistakes he'd made or what he suspected about being conned and all this other stuff like that. Completely made up it was, right? And it scapegoats this guy who's safe over there in the Netherlands entirely. And because of this, right, because the French don't have the evidence to link him to all the conspiracies to defraud people, they can't prove that he was the one behind it all, and because of this guy that's hiding off in the Netherlands, McGregor has the perfect way to get himself out of this. And McGregor's assistance to the French, quote-unquote assistance, along with this meticulous backstory that he's crafted, if you'll believe it, all of this results in a full acquittal for McGregor. The judges even praise him for being so cooperative and helpful during the investigation. And in July 1826, he walks out of the courtroom a free man. He has gotten away with it completely. Now, you would think that that would be enough for old mate Gregor McGregor and his ridiculous Poye scheme. You would think, wow, okay, once bitten, twice shy. I am done with this. It was a close shave, but I managed to get out of it. I've had enough. Of course not. Of course not. Of course Gregor McGregor isn't finished. No, 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 no. He leaves France as quick as he can, which is a wise move on his part, and he returns instead to London, where the whole Poye thing has sort of settled down quite considerably since he was last there. And it is there, back in London, that one last time he tries to get things going again, attempting to sell land and take out loans and all the rest of it, again all in the name of Poye. However, the third time was not the charm for McGregor, and all of his efforts to restart the Poye scheme are pretty lackluster failures, luckily for everyone involved this time around. You know, much like sort of when you hear the words multi-level marketing these days, you know that it's not a good idea to get involved or talk to people who are involved with it. You know, even if you don't know 100% why it's not a good idea and what exactly the con is, people now, they knew that the word Poye was a danger zone. They wanted to stay a long way away from it. They'd figured out it was too good to be true, and that McGregor, was obviously talking out his bum. And as a result, he never really made any progress the third time around. And in fact, actually, this was quite funny as well. In fact, by now, McGregor isn't the only one who's going around trying to swindle people by selling land in Poye. A number of copycat fraudsters who have never been to Poye, never heard of it, never actually been there themselves, a number of these other fraudsters, they're purporting to be representatives of Poye and setting up offices to sell land and all that sort of stuff like that. So talk about being a victim of your own success. You've got other people trying to run your con like that. So that's when you know you've made it. Anyway, eventually McGregor realizes he's not going to make any more money out of this whole Poye thing. And so he moves back to Edinburgh, where he stays for a number of relatively quiet years. It has to be said, he's put the whole con behind him there like that after having got away with it, which is quite astonishing, really. He gets away with it. He moves back to Edinburgh and lives there quite quietly up in Scotland for a number of years, until the death of his wife, Josepha, in 1838. And he actually sells up completely after after he's buried her, sells everything that he owns there in Scotland, and he leaves Scotland behind forever. He never returns. At the age of 52, he sails back across the Atlantic to Venezuela, hoping for better fortune back in Latin America. He's got one more con to pull before he hangs up his boots. And, you know, he gets on the ship, he sails across with a heart full of optimism, hoping that things are going to be better on the other side of the Atlantic, and wouldn't you know it, of course they are. He finds the success that he was hoping for on the other side there in Venezuela, because Simon Bolivar, I mean, let's not forget, actually, sorry, Simon Bolivar had threatened to hang him if he ever set foot in South America again. Bolivar, who was obviously in charge of the Venezuelan Revolution at one point, he's turned around and said, mate, if you ever come back here, I'm going to hang you, right? But luckily for our mate, well, I shouldn't say our mate, luckily for McGregor, Bolivar had died 8 years ago. And, you know, despite this lingering death threat from Bolivar, when McGregor arrives back in Caracas and, you know, obviously in classic McGregor style, walks in there, you know, walks in like he owns the place. He's got all his military uniform, his medals on, all the rest of it there like that. He struts in like he's the big head cheese. He manages to talk his way back into his old position as a high-ranking army officer. Since Bolivar's death 8 years previous, McGregor's reputation as a revolutionary war hero has recovered a fair bit. You know, there's no mention of Rio de la Hacha, there's no mention of Portobello and all the other horrendous failures that he had or anything else that he did that was terrible like that. And so he's seen as this star-studded war hero there like that. And this is enough, not only... to get him a very comfortable a pension there, you know, as a little, you know, retirement pension there like that. He also gets back pay as a member of the Venezuelan Revolutionary Army. He's got people like the Venezuelan Defense Minister, even the President vouching for him as a hero of the revolution, as both of them had been around when he'd been fighting for the Venezuelans 2 decades ago. So he is rubbing shoulders with the rich, powerful, and famous there in Venezuela, and absolutely loving life after, again, having talked his way into it after years and years have passed since he's lifted a finger for the Venezuelans. So after everything, Gregor McGregor, he got a happily ever after. Whether he deserved it or not remains to be, we can debate that until the cows come home, but he certainly got it. He lived as a respected Venezuelan citizen on a divisional general's pension until his death on the 4th of December, 1845, at the age of 58. McGregor got a full military funeral with the Venezuelan president and the military commanders of the country marching behind the coffin, this massive big funeral procession that went through the city. And you would have to think that McGregor would have been pretty bloody happy with that. As for his lasting legacy today, quite apart from his incredible life story, well, that probably fell short of where McGregor would have liked, to be honest, because his name is completely absent from the McGregor family cemetery that's near Loch Katrine here in Scotland. And as for Poirier itself, the part of Honduras that McGregor dressed up as this pretend country and spent most of his later career selling to the broad, the wider public back there in Britain and even over there in France. So, but even to this day, that area known as Poirier at one stage, it remains undeveloped and completely untouched. But that's it. That's all she wrote today, sports fans. That is the story of Gregor McGregor. And I certainly hope you enjoyed it. It was a long one, but I'd like to think it was a good one. We certainly had a couple of laughs during there as well. Although, I don't know, man. The whole sending people to their deaths thing, it makes it difficult for me to, sell this guy again as this rascal, as this rogue, because he did do a fair bit of bloody harm as well. So I don't think we should lose sight of that. Anyway, regardless of whether you look at it, how you look at this bloke, that is his story, and I do hope you enjoyed hearing about it. Anyway, we're going to close out the show as usual. Normal boring housekeeping announcements. Halfasthistory.net, your place to go to find out about the show. There's back old episodes there as well, like that. You can get in touch with the show if you want to email into me. There's a little contact form you can follow there, and as well as links to subscribe on iTunes, on Spotify, and on Apple Podcast, not Apple, what is it, Android Podcasts as well, there like that. So plenty of ways to get across the show every week. And thank you to everyone who gets in touch, and a special thank you, of course, to those supporting me on Patreon. I've got a couple of new Patreon members who've just signed up recently, and I can't say, once again, I always say this, I can't say how much it means to me to know that I've got people like you at my back. So thank you very, very much indeed to all the people supporting me financially or otherwise. It is very, very humbling, a great privilege to have people be such big fans of the show. Anyway, that's enough of that nonsense for this week. Leaving you, as ever, with a question posed on Reddit. We've got Reddit historian T. Earl Grey Hot 1701. We've talked a little bit about cons, famous cons throughout the ages. Of course, none more famous than the various pyramid schemes that we've had over the years. And T. Earl Grey Hot 1701 wants to know, how did ancient Egyptian civilization last so long if it was based on a pyramid scheme?